this program are those of the host and the participants.
All right. Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters Today. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you on WILL AM 580, Urbana, Illinois, the heart of East Central Illinois and the campus of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Today we have a live show for you, and we're going to have a show that has been long awaited here, a guest I've been trying to get for quite some time. Our guest will be Alexander Coburn, one of America's best-known investigative journalists. He's a columnist for The Nation, and along with Jeffrey St. Clair, he's the co-editor of the muckraking newsletter Counterpunch, also available on the web, updated every day, counterpunch.org, I believe. Previously, Coburn's written on the press and politics for The Village Voice, for The Wall Street Journal. He's written many, many books, or edited, and he has a new book out we're going to be talking about today. With Jeffrey St. Clair, he has edited the new book, Dimes Worth of Difference, Beyond the Lesser of Two Evils, an analysis of the current electoral situation in 2004 with regard to the presidential race in particular. In the United States, it's my pleasure to welcome now Alexander Coburn.
Hey, Bob.
Hey, Alex. Thank you very much for joining us.
You took up just a little bit.
I'll do my best. I gather we're getting some 19th century technology here we're working with, but... It's
what
great.
Do you mean? It's called a telephone.
Yeah, well, that's 19th century. So you can hear me okay now?
I can hear you.
Wonderful. Well, Alex, the new book you've got out with Jeffrey St. Clair, and I've been reading lots of material on the website, counterpunch.org, almost on a daily basis now, is Dimes Worth of Difference, Beyond the Lesser of Two Evils. What is the core of the argument of the book?
Oh, the core of the argument is that which I say flatly in the first essay of the book, is that the real issue here is the utter corruption of the American political system. The book has a number of, about a dozen essays in it. And, this is 20th century technology.
Okay.
I've got to turn off here. I just did.
Okay, thank you.
The book really goes at the corruption of the system as represented in the two main parties, the Democrats and the Republicans. And we've got essays on both. And also, a second thing it does is just remind people that we are essentially, for most practical matters, a one-party state, which, of course, has now been... It tends to be eradicated every 4 years, this unchanging verity of the American political scene, mostly by Democrats saying that we have to elect Mondale, we have to elect Dukakis, we have to elect Clinton, and now we have to elect Kerry to save civilization as we know it today. And what we try and do is actually describe what civilization was like at the end of the Clinton administration, stuff you know yourself very well, which is that, differences between rich and poor had got a lot wider, the Democrats had presided over war in Yugoslavia, blah, blah, blah. We can go into that in your program.
Yes,
so, in that sense, the book is indeed a plague on their houses, and here's what the plague is, and that is the main point of the book. I had never thought when we did this book, and we put it to press in the summer, that it would have got so we would have had a candidate, actually, of a certain amount of truth in packaging. I mean, Kerry, even by the low standards of Dukakis and Mondale, I think is the most pathetic Democratic candidate I can remember. But he also has he actually has a certain frankness in his positions. I mean, he's more for war, if it's possible, than Bush. He's more servile to to Wall Street, if possible. No, that's not possible. He's as servile to Wall Street as Bush is. It really is hard to tell a difference between them.
In your piece that you filed for the most recent Nation, and a longer version is on the Counterpunch website, I think it's titled Zombies for Kerry.
Zombies for Kerry. Why do we say zombies for Kerry? Actually, I start with a little anecdote. Jeffrey, my co-editor and the co-editor of the book as well, was at a meeting, an anti-war meeting to promote the book in Portland last week. He started doing an even-handed presentation of of Bush. He's the moral Everest of his refusal to go and kill people in Vietnam, or of course get himself injured, and his subsequent decline into the revolting specimen that he is today, and Kerry, and Kerry's own war record, which is extremely slimy. And immediately a woman in the audience, who was obviously for Kerry, led out a group of people for Kerry of about 15 people. In other words, they could not even bear to sit and listen to any kind of objective account of what Kerry had done in Vietnam. And they're zombies for Kerry. I mean, they're all over my inbox, probably over your inbox, too. They keep going. These are people who resisted the war in Vietnam, now touting Kerry as a, quote, war hero, unquote. It's the most extraordinary thing you've ever seen. They won't entertain any criticism. They constantly rush out and go on about the Swift boat stuff. They refuse to look at Kerry's record, which is awful.
Now, on the with regard to the Swift boat in Vietnam thing, when you say it's a deplorable record, are you referring to the critique O'Neill's making where Kerry lied about the caliber of his wounds and what he did, or are you referring to what he actually did in terms of maybe committing war crimes?
Both. I think, I mean, Kerry got an amazing number of medals in an incredibly quick period of time. I mean, I thought John McCain had led the route there. John McCain, I think, got nine, I once counted and did worked it out. He got nine medals for, I think, half an hour in the air over North Vietnam, dropping high explosive from 30,000 feet. Kerry, in about 3 months, managed to get, what, three Purple Hearts, a Bronze Star, and a Silver Star while sustaining no wound deeper than a scratch. It's quite an achievement.
We're talking to Alexander Coburn today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Alex is the co-editor with Jeffrey St. Clair of the new book, Dime's Worth of Difference, Beyond the Lesser of Two Evils. We're going to be talking about that book and some of his other observations on American politics today. If you want to call in with a question or comment, the phone number here at Media Matters is 333-9455. Toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. Our lines are open. I think, Alex, in the book and in your writings, you talk a lot about the similarities between the Democrats and Republicans on core issues of foreign policy and economics. You've just said that on a lot of these issues, Kerry, in fact, may well be to the right of Bush. Are there differences between Kerry and Bush that where Kerry is to the left of Bush, or where there's something of any value to progressives, do you think?
Well, I think we probably better suspend use of the word left.
Okay.
By the way, I'd like to come back to one thing in your previous remarks about the Swift boat. You said, or did Kerry actually commit war crimes? I think there's a strong case to say that he did, in the if you go through the accounts, which we've done, and you'll find it actually up on people are interested if you go to the Counterpunch website and knock in Kerry war crimes, or for me, by me and Jeffrey, there's a long analysis of actually some of his conduct, which is pretty bad. To go back to your question about left,
mm-hmm.
No, I don't think we can use the word left, and I think actually everything Kerry says about the domestic scene is pretty valueless. I mean, the basic thing about Kerry and the domestic economy is really goes back to what he said in February 9, which should have been attended to with rather more interest by the AFL-CIO than it did, which is that his main opponent in the if he was elected president would be the deficit. Now, by that single announcement, Kerry basically said he was not interested in jobs creation. He wasn't interested in trying to do any kind of real injection of energy into the economy. As we all know, this is the weakest recovery in post-war history, the famous jobless recovery, which is jobless. He was really going to please the bankers, and he, you know, cashed that in right away by appointing two former aides to Robert Rubin and putting Robert Rubin next to his wife at the Democratic Convention. You don't need anything clearer statement than that, that Kerry is not going into, is not heading to if he's elected. And by the way, I mean, here we have a situation where there's a hugely unpopular war, where the economy is in the toilet, where we had numbers at the end of last week which said, what, the number of uninsured is up to 45 million, that the poverty level has notched up another point. And yet, I was just looking at Sam Smith's conflation of the various polls, Bush is ahead before the Republican convention is ahead by 2 points.
We're talking to Alex Coburn today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. And Alex, I have great news for you. You've just set the all-time Media Matters record for filling up the phone lines. They are all locked in now. So people, we will go through callers as quickly as possible. The number here, 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. And let's go to the phone lines now. Line 2, Champagne, you're on the air.
Yes, Alex, I'd like you to talk about two topics particularly. This weekend's spy scandal and your differences with Noam Chomsky on voting in the presidential election.
Okay, well, let's go. The spy scandal, of course, has now produced this guy, Franklin. His name's being noised abroad as a guy in the DOD.
Could you, a little background on that, for some of our listeners who might not be familiar with the context, what is the spy scandal, Alex?
The spy scandal as it unfolds is allegations, and people, I know your audience will be completely stunned by this, allegations that information, classified information, United States of the government has been passed to the government of Israel. Completely horrifying piece of news, surprising to one and all. Now, obviously, in context, everybody knows that the famous neocons, Wolfowitz, Doug Feth, and the others, have had an enormously long history of very close association with successive governments of Israel. And the famous prospectus for attacking Iraq and so forth was actually originally filed as a report for an Israeli prime minister, Netanyahu, by American consultants, including Feth and these other people. So everybody with half a brain knows perfectly well that most secrets of interest to Israel are passed on an absolutely daily basis, whether it's by Pearl, Wolfowitz, or any of the other ones. However, there was an investigation by the FBI, which began as an investigation into the Valerie Plame affair. People may remember that Plame was the officer of the CIA who was the wife of Wilson, James Wilson, who the Bush people were mad at because he said that the information from the Congo about yellow cake for Iraq was bogus.
Joe Wilson.
Joe Wilson. So they began, and then, of course, Plame was outed as an officer of the CIA, and this became a matter of investigation because it actually is a felony to out a CIA officer. And in the course of these investigations, the FBI began to take an increasing interest in information of U.S. government deliberations on policy towards Iran that may have been passed to Israel. News reports at the end of last week indicated that the guy they were looking at was Franklin, who is an employee of the DOD, and also with some connection with people working for AIPAC, which is the prime American-Israel lobbying organization. Seems to me that actually what they're trying to do is cut it off at the pass and go and stick it all on Franklin and let the search stop there rather than head on up the tree towards higher people in the National Security Council. That's really what that is about. Now, it'll be interesting to see a couple of things. A, whether it goes anywhere. There are certainly a lot of people in Washington who think, you know, all information as regards of interest to Israel is like a leaky sieve, and that at some point it has to be stopped. Equally, there is any political person at this stage in the game in an electoral year is absolutely desperate not to offend the American-Israel lobby, as anyone who doubts that can just go and read John Kerry's recent column in the Jewish Forward, which is, even by the low standards on this topic, is one of the most servile displays of prostration towards one lobby that I've ever read. Absolutely extraordinary stuff. Now, on the question of voting and all that, I mean, Chomsky a while ago said, you know, there were, back in the spring, he confided to a British paper that there were, small differences translated into bigger differences when you came to the differences between Bush and Kerry. I don't know what Noam thinks at the moment, but whatever small differences there were seem to have rapidly disappeared. I mean, take foreign policy. In our book, by the way, we have a terrific essay by Gabriel Kolko, which in the end, actually, after going through it all, Kolko, of course, is a very senior and well-respected figure as a critical analyst of U.S. policy in the last century, basically saying that if you are an enemy of U.S. empire and if you wish to see that empire in its global reach and hegemony weakened, you'd be more interested in supporting Bush than you would John Kerry, who really is presenting himself as a rationalizer of the empire, a guy who can restore alliances. Remember, he's trying to bring NATO into, I mean, this is the old Howard Dean position, actually, back at the start of the year, that we shouldn't have attacked Iraq without the help of our allies and NATO troops. You look through the, where are the big differences? It's rather hard to find them. When you do find a difference, Kerry is sometimes worse. Plan Colombia, Kerry is, of course, his leading advisor, Rand Beers, was one of the architects of Plan Colombia and worked for Bush. Recently, Kerry, long before, after Noam said, made that point, Kerry said that, I think it may have lost him the election, actually. It's when he said his spokesman, Jamie Rubin, who, of course, used to be Madeleine Albright's spokesman in the Clinton State Department, said that even if he'd known that the WMD threat was bogus, Kerry would have attacked Iraq.
You think that could cost him the election?
Well, it's interesting. How else do you explain why Kerry suddenly slipped? The LA Times poll last week, for the first time this year, showed Bush ahead. Now, what's happened? What are the events that have happened? Kerry anchored the Democratic convention in him being a war hero in Vietnam from the moment he stepped on saying, you know, ready for duty or whatever nonsense they made him say. And the other thing is that Jamie Rubin made this remark. He said, this is the Kerry's position. That doesn't matter, even if the WMD. I think at that point, a lot of people said, what is the point of voting for this guy? He is he's either a fence straddler, which he certainly is, or he would have fought the war. So, and he says he's a war hero, so they just gave up on him. How else do you explain Kerry's amazing lack of bounce, of forward movement, in fact, of backward movement, since the Democratic convention? That convention, I think, in electoral terms for them, was an absolute disaster, and they've only themselves to blame.
We're talking to Alexander Coburn today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Alex is the well-known journalist and political commentator, the co-editor of Counterpunch, the newsletter, and also available on the web at www.counterpunch.org. He's also with his co-editor at Counterpunch, Jeffrey St. Clair, has a new book out, Dimes Worth of Difference, Beyond the Lesser of Two Evils. That's what we're talking about on today's show. If you'd like to call in, we do have lines open, 333-9455, the toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. I promise I will get to all callers. Line 4, Fort Worth, Texas. You're on the air with Alex Coburn.
Thank you, Bob. Alex, essentially, the Democratic and Republican parties, as Gore Vidal once said, America has one political party and it has two right wings. As long as Americans are stuck within the paradigm of the Democrat-Republican situation, we're never going to make any progress in this country. And Arianna Huffington on your show several weeks ago used the analogy of the house is on fire and this isn't the time to talk about remodeling. Mm-hmm. My analogy would be the foundation at its very core is corrupt, and you may as well let the house burn down because you got to start from the foundation up anyway. I'd appreciate Mr. Cogburn's comments.
Well, I'm with you on that one. I mean, it's funny about Arianna Huffington. She spent years writing that the foundations needed to be reformed. And then after she had a disastrous run against Schwarzenegger to become governor of California, she suddenly changed her tune and hopped back into the Democratic compound, basically.
You know, Alex, if I can follow up on a point you were talking about with Noam Chomsky earlier, what does seem interesting to me in 2004 is that there are a number of people who would be considered to the left of the Democratic Party. Noam certainly one of them, Ed Herman, Howard Zinn. Who were not people who supported Democrats in the past, including Clinton, Dukakis, Mondale, who have said tacitly, if not directly, that they're in favor of voting for Kerry this time, explicitly, not on the grounds that Kerry is any better than these other people. In fact, I think they would agree with everything you say about Kerry, but rather that Bush is much worse than previous Republicans or Democrats. He's moved the tradition to the right, especially with in a number of ways, with the neocons and with the sort of fundamentalist fervor. Do you think that's a legitimate critique of Bush in your or commentary?
Not really. I think the level I was looking in an independent bookshop in Olympia, a splendid place called Orca Books, the other day. The current politics shelf, it is of course covered with books about Bush and his villainy. You would think you were talking about Lucifer instead of an incredibly limited guy. But worse than Reagan? I mean, worse than some of the predecessors? I don't think so. I mean, the frenzy about Bush as a guy, I think is excessive. I think he's a bad president. I think he's, he's favored the rich. So did Clinton. I mean, the rich came out of the Clinton years a lot richer than they went in. The poor came out of the Clinton years poorer than they went in. You can go through it area by area. How many people have the Bush policies killed in Iraq? I don't know, what, 30,000? You want to count how many people the attacks on Yugoslavia killed, let alone, the indifference to the massacres in Rwanda under Clinton time, and you're up in 200,000, 300,000, 400,000, a million? What about 14 years of sanctions against Iraq? Nearly killing a million kids. We all forgotten all that all of a sudden. I mean, to go back to what the gentleman from Fort Worth said, the foundations are what matter here. I argue in this book, I mean, it's a little flippant, but I think the tremendous concentration every 4 years on the presidential election, the driving out of all other debate, is very harmful. This season, I think, has seen the demobilization of the American left. I mean, I speak, by the way, on a day when I think reports from New York, I'm on the West Coast, you know, say that 300,000 people are in the streets, which is great. Last year we saw, you know, the famous anti-war demonstrations. But this obsession with Bush seems to me to have demobilized the left. The things that count for the left are preparing the long-term ground. You know, let's take some of the things that are going on in the country, the living wage campaigns. Now, they've gone on, whichever president is in office, in city after city, people have fought on the absolute basic issue. Can people, you know, make it on what they're made? This is one of the fundamental points of the American economy. People can't make enough money to have a decent life, or even an approach to a decent life. Now, John Kerry is not going to improve that situation. George Bush certainly isn't going to improve that situation. The only way you do it is by organizing in terms of mass movements. American labor, it seems to me, is at an all-time low. I mean, in the American labor movement, organized labor is dropping, what, a point a year? It's down to, what, 11 million now? You know, and here they are again. In Oregon, you know, the SEIU is spending all its time, all its organizers, trying to challenge people who want Nader on the ballot. That's where all its energy is going, even though the head of the SEIU in Boston actually said that in many ways he thought a Kerry presidency would be demobilizing. And then, of course, they beat him with rolled-up copies of the Democratic Party platform until he changed his mind. I mean, if Labor is not expanding. The Labor movement isn't expanding. And John Kerry is not going to help Labor. He's not going to help Labor one bit. Bill Clinton never helped Labor in 8 years do anything substantive. Labor was weaker after 8 years than it was when it went in. Labor had those trade agreements, which, of course, were the architects for Clinton and Gore. So if the left could only get its mind off this, like, the only thing we can do is get rid of Bush, get in Kerry, then what? I asked a guy this the other day. He said, oh, then we'll go after Kerry. Right. You know, what happened in 1994, 1995, the progressive left let Bill Clinton get away with everything, murder, including murder. I'm talking about, of course, the expanded Death Penalty Act in the middle 90s. I'm talking about the eradication of welfare. All of that happened under Clinton's watch, and the left basically sat on its hands. The first big real mutiny against Clinton came in 1999 with the riots in Seattle, tremendous turnouts in Seattle, and that wasn't really the mainstream progressive left. That was the anarchists and the real troublemakers.
We're talking to Alex Coburn today, Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. I want to follow up on these points with you, Alex, but we've got some callers who are waiting. We do have phone lines open. The number 333-9455, the toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. Line 3, Champagne, thank you for your patience. You're on the air.
Yes, the National Resources Defense Council has an item on its homepage about the Bush environmental record. And if one goes and selects that, one finds a long, 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 long list, categorized by date and otherwise, of particular items where the Bush administration has presided over a very systematic destruction of the environment and of previous governmental efforts to help the environment. And each one of these, if selected, gives a long description of all the details. And this is the destructiveness of the Republicans compared with the Democrats with respect to the environment. It goes back several administrations. And I find your attitude that it doesn't make any difference which of the candidates we vote for in this election to be entirely irresponsible. And the notion that we might as well, that the American house is in such terrible state that we might as well burn it down, is one that I'm really surprised that Mr. McChesney has you on his program.
Bob, can I respond to this?
Yeah, please do.
Well, the speaker, first of all, it's always interesting how liberals, whenever they hear something they don't like, they immediately say, why is the guy talking at all? They're quicker than the right wing to want to get unwelcome opinion off the air altogether. I will make that as a general point, not just about this character. Secondly, he's quoting the NRDC. a more servile adherent to the Democratic Party than the NRDC, the National Resources Defense Council, can hardly be found. And that's a general characteristic of the mainstream and, in fact, almost all the environmental movement. And in my judgment, the environmental movement in recent years has done itself immeasurable harm by allowing itself basically to become an appendage of the Democratic National Committee. That's true of the Sierra Club, it's true of the League of Conservation Voters, it's true of NARDC, it's true of all the major ones. Their claims that Bush is worse than all the others is frankly ludicrous. Just to take one example, logging rates under Clinton-Gore were 6 times higher than they've been in the Bush administration, and that's not just because they've cut down all the trees. Logging rates were way higher. When you go through the record, actually, since basically Nixon time, Nixon, of course, the Republican president, was the person who put through the Endangered Species Act, who put through, you know, probably, certainly the greatest environmental law that's ever been put on the books. Nixon didn't do it because he particularly loved trees. He did it because he was trying to divide opposition against him. Above all, Nixon did this because there was huge popular pressure at that time for a change. Presidents and congresses and Supreme Courts respond to social movements. This goes back to what the gentleman from Fort Worth, and I agree with him, was saying about get the foundations changed. In the 50s, people said, we cannot go on with this form of racism in our society. They created the movements to which other people responded. Now, when you go through the environment, let's look at a few things in Clinton time. One of the greatest laws on the books, which was put through in the 50s, was the Delaney Clause, which simply said that no carcinogen could be added to processed food. It was a blanket ban. For years and years, the food industry fought against this through one administration after another. And yes, in Clinton time, without a murmur from the NRDC or from any of the major environmental groups who didn't even mention it, the Delaney Clause was wiped out. That will probably result in over a long time in a very large number of deaths. You can actually work your way through the environmental thing. It's since Nixon, through Carter, through his successors, it's been pretty much a straight line down.
Can I ask you, Alex, on the one point about the foresting and the clearing of logs, that Clinton's rate was 6 times higher?
Yep. I mean,
Came in and actually tightened it up, or is it simply that all the trees were cut down?
No, it wasn't. I said that wasn't because all the trees were cut down. There were, for one thing, you know, the Clinton-Gore people successfully bought off the environmental movement. There were less challenges. In the Northwest forests, there were the famous deals that Clinton-Gore brokered just because people like your chapter there in Urbana-Champaign said, you know, the Democrats are great and the Republicans aren't. They didn't look at it. If the environmentalists stood back, I'd like to make one more point about the NRDC. Mm-hmm. They were enormously enthusiastic advocates of deregulation, and one of their prime, they said, which firm did they say really showed the way to manage energy properly? They were big backers of Enron. You know, the environmental movement in the form of the NRDC and these others are of mad apostles of free market, what they call free market forces. And they allowed, you know, Enron to go on the rampage. And by the way, Enron was Bill Clinton's favorite energy company for a long time, just as it was George Bush's. You've got to get out of the box of thinking just the Republicans are bad. They're not. They're bad, but the Democrats are just as bad.
Do you think if someone, say, like a Dennis Kucinich or Jesse Jackson, were to win the nomination somehow for the Democratic Party, could they have any hope of altering this logic, or is it deep wired?
Well, no. I mean, I think if Kucinich or a Jackson, by the way, I mean, on Jackson, we have a fantastic essay in the book by Joanne Wifidziewski about the Rainbow Campaign. It's almost incredible now to look back from 2004 and the utter demobilization of the left, their complete silence on one issue after another, their refusal to attack Kerry on something as disgusting as his support for the Colombian repression or for his attacks on Chavez. I mean, it's an absolutely unnumbered list. If you go back and look at the Jackson campaigns of 84 and 88, you had a real popular movement. Now, Jackson, you know, had staggering results in 88 because it was a brilliant organization. They actually went into these states and they won an enormous number of votes. What was the response of the Democratic Party to the Jackson campaign, to the Rainbow campaign? You know, you had the women got defense of marriage, so did the gays. The black people got the war on drugs, and now you've got, 2 million people in prison, a disproportionate number of them black. One thing after another, the Democrat, Labor got NAFTA. That was the response of the Democratic Party in the 90s to the last genuine popular upsurge within the Democratic Party. If Jackson became president tomorrow by fiat of Almighty God or Kucinich, they could do nothing unless they represented a popular movement. Did Kucinich harness a popular movement this year? I don't think he did. And his ultimate function was just to say to people, oh, yeah, by the way, forget what I was saying about anti-war. You've all got to vote for John Kerry.
We're talking to Alexander Coburn today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We've got a couple phone lines open. We will get to all callers. The number is 333-9455. The toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Alexander Coburn is one of our best-known investigative journalists, a columnist for The Nation magazine, and a co-editor with Jeffrey St. Clair of Counterpunch, the newsletter, also available online at www.counterpunch.org, and the co-editor with St. Clair of the new book, Dimes Worth of Difference, Beyond the Lesser of Two Evils, that we're talking about today. And that book is published by AK Press.
No, it's published by Counterpunch, AK.
By Counterpunch, AK Press.
You can actually get it by calling up Counterpunch if you want to say the number, or I can.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, if you want this terrific book, you can just dial 1-800-840-3683, 1-800-840-3683, and order up a copy from Becky Grant, our business manager, or you can go online at counterpunch.org and order it online.
Okay, well, let's
go back. You have the brains of Einstein to do that, but, or Mrs. Einstein, I should say.
Let's go back to the phone lines. Line 1, Shelbyville, you're on the air with Alexander Coburn.
Yes, I was wondering if this man had ever heard of the Project for the New American Century, the PNAC.
Yeah, in fact, I was sort of alluding to it earlier when I said that, you know, many of the officials in senior in the Bush administration had connections with Israel that go back to the, well, I didn't use the specific organization, but I was alluding it to it, the Project of the American Century, and behind that to the original report to Benjamin Netanyahu.
Oh, back they in formed, the, you know, in 1992.
Exactly.
And in 1998 is when they wrote a letter to Clinton saying we've got to go into Iraq, right?
Yeah.
You know, and that's on the website. It's 2 pages.
Yeah.
And then, you know, these are all the people that we know so well. It begins with Cheney, Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz.
Yeah, but I should say one thing. I mean,
18
people. Again, don't forget that, you know, back at the end of the Gore campaign, Al Gore, in the right through the 90s and 92 and up to 2000 in his 2000 campaign, was calling for an attack on Iraq. I think the only problem I have with this, you know, endless reiteration of the neocons as if they were a specific Bush lobby is you're talking about a, you know, a very substantive wide force in American politics, and to try and narrow it down to 2 or 3 guys, it might be useful, but it isn't really all.
You know, it wasn't 3 or 4 guys. It was 18.
No, I think that's preposterous. You see, it's not 18.
I have.
So, no, I know you've got
if
names.
You'll go to
you can
website,
read all the names.
Out.
No,
18.
I don't agree with this at all. I think it's a huge mistake to say there are 18 people and they're the guilty parties. You're talking about a structural relationship between countries. If you took the 18 people out, stood them up against a wall and shot them, you'd have another 18 doing exactly the same thing.
Reminds me of my 8th grade civil teacher who said there's always money behind it. Now, 4 of those men are with the Rand Corporation, Lockheed Martin, Vice President of Booz Allen, and Halliburton Contractor. And those were the ones we did have in the administration. They all went to work for the administration. But
well,
that really, I want to tell you
I mean,
something
you're quite
else.
Right. I'm not challenging
you have said some
I'm
of
just saying
ridiculous
it's, you know,
things
it's,
I have ever heard. To
well,
begin with.
Well, do you want to go on?
No, okay. Well, let's have one person speak at a time. Caller, do you want to make a closing comment?
Yeah, I think that we should think about the Vietnam War and that Kerry went to them when 19,000 had been killed.
Okay, well,
they refused it, and it ended up being 55,000.
Okay, thank you, Colin. Let me assess you on her last point there, Alex. You know, we've seen all this stuff in the news the last couple of weeks about Kerry and the Swift boat and whether his war behavior in Vietnam. You know, it just came out a few days ago that the lieutenant governor of Texas,
Bonds.
Has acknowledged that not only did he, as a favor, let George W. Bush skip to the head of the sort of the elite National Guard crew that wouldn't have to go overseas, but he routinely did this for wealthy people in Texas, and he felt tremendous guilt about it. And George W. Bush is on record as saying that he knows he did not get such service, and his father as well, so contradicting, I mean, what we used to call a lie.
We can call it a lie. I don't think
it is a lie.
It's not illegal under the Patriot Act yet.
But I mean, the point is, it's striking, isn't it, that one of these is a major news story that everyone in the country knows about, and the other one would probably be known by 2% of the population.
Oh, I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, Barnes's statement is a very strong one. He says he went to the Vietnam War and he looked at that and he felt deep shame for having helped George Bush and other rich people when he was in a position to do so as a very powerful lobbyist and operator in Texas. I mean, Barnes, by the way, is the largest contributor to the Kerry campaign in the state of Texas last time I looked. No, I quite agree with you. There are endless unfairnesses. Don't think I'm a friend of George Bush. I mean, I think George Bush, I think it's ridiculous for people who opposed the Vietnam War to bleat about George Bush being a draft dodger. I thought we were all in favor at that point of people dodging the draft or evading it or going to Canada, which Bush apparently thought of doing. I think that's ludicrous to do that. With Kerry, some of the statements he made when he came back from Vietnam were excellent when he made his remarks about war crimes. The trouble with Kerry is he can never stick to one thing for very long. It's like, you know, he gave a tremendous speech at Yale against the war and promptly went and enlisted, to go to Vietnam and was, everybody says, a very gung-ho killer in Vietnam. Then he comes back and he's good. He's very vociferous. But then, of course, he can't throw his own medals over the wall because he's worrying about his political credibility and all the rest of it. And since then, he's flopped backwards and forwards. And now, most recently, he has said, no, maybe he spoke. This guy, Jamie Rubin, who made this completely disastrous remark, insanely stupid remark about, you know, he'd attack Iraq if it was, even if he'd known that the WMD thing was bogus. Now, of course, Rubin has been told to go out and say he misspoke and maybe he misrepresented Kerry. And people will say one more time, with perfect accuracy, this guy is a flip-flopper. He can't make up his mind what he really believes. So they finally do go. He utterly nullifies his excellent position on the war in Vietnam, and he now says, of course, everybody, Bill Clinton and all the rest of them, praise him tremendously for being a war hero, and they play the whole Democratic convention as, you know, a sort of float, a political float for a war hero, and that, what do they get? They get their just desserts, as I just said, which is he drops in the polls.
Let's go back to the phone lines now. Line 4, San Francisco, you're on the air with Alex Coburn.
Quick question for a man I really admire. What do you think of George Soros and MoveOn? Do you think we're making an idol out of that organization or of George Soros? That's my question.
Thank you.
I'm no admirer of George Soros. I mean, George Soros is another classic example of one of the things wrong. Actually, on our website today, we have a column by me saying some of the things that I've been saying to you guys. But in it, I quote Arundhati Roy, a speech she made in San Francisco on August 16th, in the course of which she has some really, really smart things to say about non-governmental organizations, NGOs, as they're called. You know, these outfits, whether they're Oxfam or whether they're, you know, human rights groups, and the role, very often baneful, that they play. Why? Because they themselves rely on funders, rich funders like George Soros, who is a currency speculator. And in the end, they'll dance to the tune of their funders, and they'll always try and maintain their political respectability or viability. So in the end, they exercise a very baneful group in politics. And Arundhati Roy's remarks, which I quote in my column, are really worth reading. Now, Soros is a good example of all this. I think, you know, whether it's in all his efforts on drug policy, which tends to demobilize popular efforts, such as we're familiar with, particularly in California, in favor of, you know, the Soros-type operations, which are, you know, very mainstream. And MoveOn.org is a good example of this. They're a Democratic lobbying organization. They never have a single thing of interest to say, you know, about what our real political situation, what the real political scene is. I mean, don't forget, one of the things is in this current political battle, there are only about 30 seats in the House of Representatives that are actually up for contention. The whole thing is so gerrymandered now that most people are there for life. You can't get them out. Of course, this was done by first the Democrats, and particularly by the late, great Burton, and now by the Republicans in places like Texas. I mean, the stuff is rotted to the core. Now, it is just possible. People are so now uninterested in what's happening in other races. Quite recently, the LA Times had not yet bothered to put a story on its front page about the, you know, Senate races in California. It's all this Bush, Kerry, Bush, Kerry, Bush, Kerry.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing about the real huge structural corruption that is endemic in the system. I mean, we may end up now. I think people are a huge turnoff. I think this election is a huge turnoff. I think people are just stopping taking much interest in it. People I talk to, they can't stand Bush, quite rightly. They're much like, oh, they don't. Well, they're beginning not to be able to stand Kerry either. I think you could have a less than 50% turnout, and you could have the eventual winner elected by less than a plurality. I think people are just saying this thing is meaningless.
And before we go to the next caller, and we do have a few callers, so I guarantee we'll get to all of you and give you time to ask your questions.
Is that a campaign promise there?
It's a campaign promise, and that's my word, and I'll stick to it. You can hold me to it. What is your take on the Nader campaign, the Greens? I mean, if someone's going to go to vote, they're going to do their civic duty in November, and they don't want to vote for Bush, and they don't think Kerry's going to be much better or worth putting any energy into. What do you think of the other choices on the ballot?
Well, I think the Greens, I mean, with this Cobb thing is absolutely ludicrous. I mean, I think they made themselves into a comic opera. I mean, Cobb got the so-called Green nomination by the most appalling vote finagling that you've ever seen. It makes what the Republicans did in 2000 look like a Tea Party. I'm a huge admirer of Ralph's. I think he's made tremendous. I don't agree with everything Ralph said. I think he's got a mania about food, which is kind of sick. But, you know, he barely eats anything. He's afraid of germs and stuff like that. But I think Ralph, on the whole, is terrific. I mean, he's made real major substantive changes in American politics, which is a measure of the hostility he's drawn. And I think it's absolutely right. One of the other deplorable things of this election period is all these people on the left, the liberal left, saying he shouldn't run. Why shouldn't he run? He's got a perfect right to run. I mean, I've never seen such venom. I mean, it's far more than the venom directed against George Bush, against Ralph. Exercising, and I think Ralph has made major things. Just take his remarks about the Israeli lobby. He's actually, I mean, for years, Ralph, of course, kept quiet about the Israeli lobby because you were always worried he'd be baited as a Palestinian if he did. And he thought he had enough on his plate without getting the charge of anti-Semite thrown at him. But now he's really, you know, he's having a very good, excellent battle with Foxman of the ADL, responding to that organization's efforts to taunt him. He's made terrific statements about the West Bank. You want to find John Kerry saying anything about it otherwise than, you know, slavish posture towards Israel, the same as George Bush? I mean, my God, you ought to read what John Kerry wrote in the Jewish Forward. Have I just said that? Probably did.
Yeah, you did.
And then Nader actually is saying things, but Nader knows how power works. There's a famous story that when Carter was becoming president, he sat down with Nader, and Nader told him for 3 hours exactly how Washington worked. And, of course, Carter paid no attention. Ralph really knows where it's at. I think sometimes he's missed a few tricks in his campaign. But just to have Ralph out there is really good. He's sharp as a tack, and he knows what he's doing.
Let's go back to the phone lines now. We've got Alexander Coburn as our guest today, the co-editor with Jeffrey St. Clair of the new book, Dimes Worth of Difference, Beyond the Lesser of Two Evils. Line one, Urbana, you're on the air with Alex Coburn.
Yeah, Ralph Nader is an egotistical prima donna who has nothing to contribute right now to the American political experience. I don't think he's doing any good at all. But that's not my main point. You said a little while back that the left wing is quicker to get dissenting opinion off the air than the right wing is. That is an obscene distortion of the truth. I have heard time and time again on this very radio station talk show hosts allowing 5 or 10 minutes in a one-hour program to dissenting right-wing opinion without making any, even the slightest attempt to cut them short or take them off the air, including Bob McChesney himself on this very radio program, giving people on the other side plenty of time to air their views. There's also a guy up in Chicago who I've heard be very, very forgiving and lenient.
Hey, Bob, get this guy off.
whereas on the other
off, the hook.
Whereas on the other hand, I've heard these right-wing talk show hosts yelling and screaming at people who disagree with them, telling them to shut up and just hanging up with them, on them after a few questions. So that's not even remotely conceivably close to the truth.
Okay, Alex, you want to respond to that?
No, not particularly.
Okay,
let's go on.
Okay, let's go to our next caller. Line 2, Crystal Lake, you're on the air with Alex Coburn.
Yeah, hi. I think that the Ralph Nader is a very good guy. I think, though, that we have to work for the Democratic senators and representatives as our real salvation. But even if Kerry's elected, he's a far better man than Bush. Bush has knew about this terrorism of the World Trade Towers. He knew that in advance. Richard Clark told him, and the local FBI agencies warned him, and also there were many other warnings of this terrorist attack. Bush and party knew all about it, and also Bush purposely had tax cuts just to eliminate social programs like social welfare, Social Security, Medicare, aid to women and children, these programs. And I think that at least Kerry, if he carries the party, will help a whole lot. And everybody is so scared of anymore of George Bush. He's as bad as Ronald Reagan and worse. And he appoints only corporate people to run the country. And I don't think, even if Kerry does, I don't even like Robin Rubin either, but even so, we have to get rid of all the corporate people and hope that with a Democratic president, perhaps we can avoid a Newt Gingrich or a Tom DeLay. These are the things we have to do, get rid of the top guy. And I just think that it's a disaster for the people. We'll be back. Worse deals, civil liberties. We'll be afraid to speak if we get Bush and Ashcroft in party to eliminate, to even look at library records and just go in and steal any information on people. I think we have to have a Democratic leadership because it carries a lot of the party and a lot of weight.
Well, thank you very much, caller. Alex, one of the things that people often ask me, and I've heard in conversations with people, say, okay, if you vote for Nader or a Green or a third party, what's the end game? And won't we be having the same conversation 4, 8, 12, 16, 20 years from now? What's the strategic game that gets us out of the current impasse? Is there one, or is it simply a protest vote?
You mean what are our short and long term objectives?
Yeah, I mean how?
I mean, if the Nader campaign, I mean, one of the things I've slightly said, I'm not sure the Nader campaign is, you know, really assisted in building social movements. I mean, it is maybe a little bit more about Ralph and Kamejo. I mean, but Ralph, you know, a guy like that fellow just now who said, you know, he's a negatistical prima donna. I mean, what a ridiculous thing to say about a guy who's been in the struggle since 1960. I mean, are you so arrogant as not to think that Ralph doesn't have core beliefs, that he doesn't think that Kerry, as much as Bush, is not going to change, corporate domination in this country? I mean, your last caller made some nice points. But, of course, you know, the corporations were never more dominant than in the Clinton years. People don't seem to be prepared to look back at Clinton, who came in, don't forget, in 1992 as a man with tremendous promises to the left on, you know, the greatest opportunity we'll see in many years to get universal health care. What happened? Hillary Clinton presided over a program that completely failed. Actually scuppered all ideas of reform, and here we are in 2004 with 45 million people uninsured, and the Clintons bear a huge measure of the blame for that, a huge measure. Bush wasn't given a mandate to change health care and didn't get in on that basis. And, of course, anyone who looks at the Clinton years will see that, you know, don't forget the parties in the Lincoln bedroom. I mean, the thing was freighted with corporate chieftains. I mean, John Kerry has never said one word to suggest, and I don't think he'd be so foolish as to do so, that his administration, like all other administrations, it won't be completely overloaded with corporate chieftains, because why? He's paid for with mostly with corporate money.
On that note, we've only got a couple minutes left. We've got two callers. I promised, as you know, to get to them as a campaign promise.
Mm-hmm.
Line 3, Urbana, you're on the air with Alex Coburn.
Yeah, Bob, you just kind of touched the point, and it kind of got derailed. You know, what are we supposed to do as you know, someone who's considered left in the United States? Caller after caller after caller come in and said it again. Bob, you just said it. What's the long-term plan? Instead of getting a long-term plan, we get, well, Clinton sucked. Well, you know what?
Well, I've given you a long-term plan. Let me go on, Bob, because I know what the guy's going to say.
Before you go on, please define what burning down the house is. Is that civil war? What are you talking about?
Okay, well, Alex,
I never said anything about burning down a house, did I?
Well, just burning down to the foundations, I think.
Well, no, talking about foundations doesn't mean burning. I didn't say anything about burning down a house. Anyway, Of course, there are long-term campaigns. What are the big issues in this country? 6.7 million people under the supervision of the Justice Department. That means campaigns on sentencing. It means campaigns to get the drug laws revised. It means campaigns to stop having these mandatory sentences. It means all those campaigns on justice issues, long-term campaigns in communities. Most people in this country have someone who's in the joint or has a relative who's in the joint. That's a campaign. Living wage campaigns are a campaign. Death penalty stuff's a campaign. Local environmental injustice is a campaign. There is no, like, secret formula held by 18 people. This is, we all know what the big issues are. We live in a prosecutorial bonanza here. These are the things that have to be changed. Labor, the only way Labor can get ahead is by building coalitions at the local level. That's no secret. The guy says, you know, I haven't said what the structural things are. We write it all the time on the website. Palestinian issues. When I came to America, you could barely, in the 70s, you could barely use the word Palestine. You can now. But in many cities, there are sister city projects building solidarity with Palestinian places. That is a long-term campaign. There's no politician in the mainstream who would even say good morning to you. I could list them all out, and I will next week if anyone wants to go to you. We do it all the time to say that we avoid the fact that long-term, the issues that plague this country have nothing to do with presidential campaigns. You never hear from John Kerry anything about the World Bank. You never hear anything about the financial institutions that control the planet. Why? Because in that sense, we are a one-party state. But that doesn't mean that for years there haven't been campaigns against World Bank, against dams in the third world.
Alex,
we all know these issues.
Let's go to our last caller, and then you can have hopefully a chance to respond to them, too. Line 4, Chicago, you're on the air with Alex Coburn.
I wanted to say amen, amen to all of your last statements, and you hit the nail on the head when you said the real problem is that will people even turn out to vote. I think with this focus on Vietnam, they're losing all of the under 30s who have a very poor voting record anyway. And what the biggest thing that I see is the shame that maybe the next president will be elected by 20% or less of the population.
All right, Alex.
Contrast that with Venezuela, where Mr. Chavez got, a turnout in the 90s and got 58.5%. This is a guy who's been attacked by both Bush and Kerry.
You know, I think what the caller was getting to before, if I put words in his mouth, the previous caller, was how that mass movement translates eventually into political power at a national level. I mean, really changing things around.
Well, I think it's slower. Look, people constantly go on about the Supreme Court. Why did people like Brennan get onto the Supreme Court back in the 50s? Why do people get into Congress who turn out to be good? Why do eventually you have candidates around the place? Because ultimately, they respond to social movements. And most people in Congress now will pay lip service to freedom for people to have the kind of sex they want. Now, that is in response to the movements of the 70s. There's no, like, micromanagement of the gearing between a mass movement and its political consequences. It comes up when you go back and look in the 70s, you'll find people all over Washington in the public interest movement.
On that note, I got to tell you that I'm getting the signal. We got to go off the air. I want to thank Alex Coburn very much for being our guest today, author of Dimes Worth the Difference. I'll be back 1 week from today. See you, Alex.
Support for today's broadcast comes from the Yoga Institute of Champaign-Urbana, offering beginner-level instruction in Iyengar yoga and special classes for men, women, teens, seniors, healthy heart, plus size, knees, low back, neck, and shoulders. New classes start after Labor Day. Information at 344-YOGA or on the web at yoga-cu.com.
Cloudy with scattered showers today, then becoming partly sunny by the afternoon. High of 73 degrees, north winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. Partly cloudy tonight, patchy fog after midnight. Low of 55 degrees, north winds 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow should be partly sunny, patchy fog in the morning. High around 80 degrees, north winds around 10 miles per hour. And tomorrow night, partly cloudy, low in the upper 50s, north winds around 5 miles per hour. In the evening, shifting to the west after midnight.